Welcome to New Books in Sports. My name is Bruce Berglund, and I'm your host. Each week, we choose an interesting new book on the world of sports, and we interview the author. This week, we are looking at what was once regarded as the greatest endurance challenge for an athlete, swimming the English Channel. Our guest is Gavin Mortimer. His book is titled The Great Swim, and it's published by Walker Books. In our interview, Gavin and I talk about how his project for The Great Swim was rejected by several publishers for being just a swimming book. In fact, his book is anything but just about swimming. Gavin focuses on the attempts of four American women to swim the channel in the summer of 1926, but he puts their stories into a broader context, looking at women's changing roles in society, at debates about the proper behavior and fashion for women, and at the influence of the popular media and the emergence of a celebrity culture that worshipped athletes as idols. The central character of Gavin's book is the 19-year-old American Gertrude Ederle, who not only became the first woman to cross the channel, but also broke the previous record set by a male swimmer by nearly 2 hours. But while Gertrude Ederle was an extraordinary swimmer, she was unprepared and unsuited for the media circus that surrounded her after her swim. And in the years immediately following, her life took a tragic turn, in part due to her inability to play the role of a celebrity. Gavin's book offers a vivid picture of the 1920s, the time of jazz music, flappers, and Jack Dempsey. It is, as he says in his interview, one of his favorite time periods to read and write about, as it is for me. And I really enjoyed speaking to Gavin about his book. So let's turn to the interview. Gavin, welcome to New Books on Sports. Thank you for taking time to join us today.
A pleasure, Bruce.
I want to start by asking about your background. You've written on a wide and interesting range of subjects: Antarctic explorers, the Battle of Britain during the Second World War, aviation history, most recently an English spy during the American Civil War. And I'll tell you, so I teach history at a small college in the States, and I have a lot of students who would be envious of you as someone who travels the world, who researches and writes books about such a wide variety of colorful topics. And to top it off, you get to live in Paris. So you have a nice line of work. How did you manage that?
I do. I started off, I've always been interested in writing. And in fact, when I was a student myself in my high school days, the two things that I was only good at were sports and English. And so in a way, I've been able to combine the two. I came into writing in my mid-20s. And the themes, as you pointed out, Bruce, I write quite a diverse range of topics, but I suppose the best way to sum it up is that what fascinates me are ordinary people doing extraordinary things. And in a book such as The Great Swim, we've got someone like Gertrude Ederle. That's a wonderful story, and not very well known stories too. So really, shining the spotlight on historical figures who, for one reason or another, have been overlooked. And so perhaps just giving them their moment in the spotlight, even though most of them are long since dead.
And so, as you said, this is a little-known story. What's the story behind the book? How did you find out about Gertrude Ederle?
Well, I'd always been vaguely aware of her, Bruce, because I'm actually coming from London, England, and I grew up in the south of England. Obviously, the Channel and the whole Channel swimming. Every sort of British schoolboy and schoolgirl grows up knowing a vague bit about it and the history, and that Matthew Webb in 1875 was the first person to swim the Channel. And so I knew that Gertrude Ederle had been the first woman. And it's quite a funny story how I really came upon the whole Great Swim of 1926 and the four American women, because I was actually in the British Library researching another topic entirely. Funnily enough, the Battle of Little Bighorn and the participation of a Scotsman in the battle. And I was looking up the 50th anniversary to see if I could find any mention of this man. So 50th anniversary, 1876 to 1926. And alas, I couldn't find anything out about that man. But what I did find was this whole epic Channel Swim story. And not just Gertrude Edley, but the three others, Clarabelle Barrett, Neil Gade, and Lillian Cannon. And I thought to myself, wow, this is fascinating. And I've never heard anything about it. I've never heard of Clarabelle Barrett or Lillian Cannon. And so that's really what led me into it.
Okay, so we're going to get to your characters or your subjects in a second. But before we get started about talking about Edderley and these other swimmers, I want to ask you about the challenge of swimming the English Channel. So having grown up in the south of England, and I know that you're a long-distance swimmer yourself, tell us, what is the difficult thing about swimming the Channel? Because it's not simply the distance, is it?
No, not at all. It's really, as a crow flies, it's only about 19 miles from the shortest point, Dover to Calais. Mm-hmm. So it's not that great a distance. The two factors that defeat the vast majority of people who take on the challenge are A, the temperature of the water. As anyone who's ever been to England knows, it's not the warmest country in the world. And really, there's a very small window for swimming it, which is around about the end of June to the end of August. And even then, it's only about, if you're lucky, 18 degrees. So it's not warm. Now, the other thing is that it's the tidal. There's two tides, the ebb tide and the flood tide. They change approximately every 6 hours. So to swim the channel, you don't just get in the water and swim in a straight line. You zigzag. You've got to zigzag according to when the tides change. And if you get that wrong, then you're going to be pushed further out to sea because it's two small promontories, really. And the landing, particularly if you're going from England to France, there's not much to play with. And if you get it wrong and you're pushed past the land, out further out to sea, then you're going to head up somewhere in the Spain, probably. It's pretty tough. It's the distance isn't a factor. It's the temperature and the tides.
And have you made a long swim personally in the channel?
No. I have been in the channel on my vacation, but really, you don't want to dawdle too long in the channel unless you have to. And as I talk about in the book, anyone who swims a channel will have about four layers of grease. In the old days, it used to be sheep fat, because you're not allowed to use any sort of wetsuits. And as I said, it's very cold. So no, there are better places to swim in the world, Bruce, than the channel.
And you didn't talk about sea creatures, because sea creatures do fit in with a couple of the unsuccessful attempts.
They do, absolutely. Nowadays, it's one of the channel is one of the busiest shipping lanes in the world. But back in the nearly 100 years ago, it wasn't ships that were the problem. There were a lot. I mean, you still get these huge basking sharks, which are very harmless, but they're anything from about 5 meters to 8-9 meters long, and they just cruise along and with their mouths open, swallowing little fish. But they're pretty scary particularly if you're fatigued and you see a fin in the water. And there's jellyfish. There's hundreds of jellyfish. Now, I have been stung by one of the jellyfish in one of the few times that I have been in the channel, and they're pretty vicious, this sting. Sea creatures are another obstacle, if you like, to swimming the channel.
So by the summer of 1926, the year that the book focuses on, there had only been a handful of successful crossings up to that point. Could you tell us about those, please?
That's right. There'd only been, I think, five men had swum the channel. No female had managed to swim the channel. Several had tried, the first being an Austrian woman in around about, I think, 1900. The second man to swim the channel was actually Gertrude Edley's trainer, Bill Barrett, a Yorkshireman who lived in, like me, lived in Paris. But he did it only at, I think he's... After many unsuccessful attempts. And one man who again features in The Great Swim, Jabez Wolf, had tried on 22 occasions to swim the channel. And there are, again, something that I found fascinating, that many people who tried to swim, and this guy, Jabez Wolf, on one occasion got to within 300 yards of touching down. But as I said, the tide suddenly changed. And if you've been in the water for 15 hours, you're at the very limits of your exhaustion, and the tide changes, it shatters you, it destroys you mentally, psychologically. And he gave up. And he wasn't the only one. Many people have fell within, almost within touching distance of their goal. So it's it really was in those days one of the, obviously in 1926, when the great swim is set, no one had climbed Everest. And it was, if you like, the holy grail of physical achievements. And the Olympics was beginning to take off, but the channel in what was a romantic age of exploration, and the North Pole and the South Pole had only been reached a generation before. The channel was, people could see it. It was there. So there was a certain cachet to it, if you like. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So in the summer of 1926, it seemed in reading your book that the channel was crowded with swimmers who were training and preparing to make the swim, and they're bumping into each other at the hotel on the French side. So how many swimmers, male and female, were there that summer? And you talk about this small window that they had to work with, and so it seemed like daily new people were going in the water.
That's right. There were six women, four Americans, an English woman, and a French woman. Then there were about, another six men, a couple of Germans, a couple of English. Oh, and the wonderful Isaac Helmy, an Egyptian, who would a very wealthy Egyptian who would turn up every year in the hope of swimming the channel, but he was there more for the party than the actual swimming. So yes, it was. You say it was a lot of people there. Most of them gathered on the French side, there was a great rivalry, particularly among the Americans. And something that surprised me when I was researching the book was just the level of hostility, if you like, between the swimmers, because there was a lot at stake. We may think of the 1920s as being a sport back then. It was all amateur, and it was there wasn't the competitiveness and that sort of a ruthless professionalism that there is today. But not at all. They knew that riches would go to the woman who was the first to succeed. So there was a lot at stake.
So yeah, let's talk about the women. And as you said, the book focuses on the women trying to make the crossing. And in particular, you focus on the four American women. Could you give us just a brief sketch of those four subjects?
Sure. Starting with Gertrude Edley, she had first tried to swim the channel in 1925 and had failed after 9 hours in the water when she was about halfway across, really, because, I mean, at the time she was 18 when she first attempted the channel in 1925. She'd won a bronze medal, individual medal, and a team gold at the 24 Olympics. And she was probably the best swimmer in the sprint swimmer. And I think, you know, with rather the arrogance of youth, if I can put it that way, in 1925, she thought the channel was fairly easy. It was, as I said, it was just sort of misguidedly thinking you just swam from A to B and that was it. And she started out very strongly and then just blew up really halfway across and was taken out. She came back in 1926, sponsored by Patterson, Captain Patterson, who was one of the owner of a Chicago Tribune and one of the wealthy newspaper magnates of the day. Then you had Lillian Cannon, who was a very, I suppose you will say now, a blonde bombshell from Baltimore, sponsored by the Scripps Howard newspaper organization. She held the record for the fastest swim across Chesapeake Bay, and was, I think, 23, and really sort of the all-American, if you like. Gertrude Edley was born in New York, but her family was from Germany, had immigrated to the U.S. at the end of the 19th century. Lillian Cannon was the all-American blue-eyed blonde. Then you had Clarabel Barrett, who was about 200 pounds, 6'2", and You know, to be blunt, from a newspaper's perspective, she couldn't get any sponsorship because she just didn't look good in a bathing suit. You know, just make no bones about it. That was how it went in those days. Because an interesting point to make, Bruce, is that and one of the reasons why the female channel swimming, female swimming in particular, was so popular this time was because it was the old adage, sex sells. It was one about the only way where newspaper editors could print photos of women, show women's legs. And so you had these gratuitous photos in all the newspapers of the day of these young female swimmers in their bathing costumes. And
I'll throw in, and in the book you have several reproductions of the sports pages, of the newspaper pages. And so it wasn't simply a single photo. You would have these montages across the width of the paper with all of these photos and different poses of the women in their swimming suits.
Absolutely. Yes. No, it was shameless exploitation. So you had Clarabel Barrett, who was a good swimmer. She was a swimming instructor at a school in New York. She lived just outside New Rochelle, just outside New York City. And then you had Mill Gade, who was of Danish origin, but had come to the U.S. just after the First World War, I think in 1919, married a U.S. naval officer, Clementon Corson, and she had first tried to swim the channel in 1923, had failed. But she was she was championed by the American mothers. So she was a little bit, she was in her late 20s, had two young children, and she was popular because another point, Bruce, to make is that this was obviously the jazz age, the flapper generation. Lillian Cannon and Gertrude Edley wore their hair in bobs. They liked to dance. They rouged, which was shocking to an older generation of American women. Mill Gade was much more conservative, wore her hair long, dressed more sensibly, and had two children. So she was, I suppose, the conservative America's favorite. So you had really four different personalities, which again was all added to the sense of rivalry, if you like. They're all represented something different, they were all from the East Coast, but from New York City, from Baltimore, and from just from sort of upstate New York.
And you mentioned earlier the rivalries between these women, and the principal rivalry, at least at first, is between Edderly and Cannon. Could you explain why this was such a rivalry?
Well, they were both sponsored by rival newspapers. The New York Daily News sponsored Gertrude Edderly, and the Baltimore Post, part of the Scripps Howard organization, sponsored Cannon. They were both the young ones, as I said, the young, hip, trendy flappers, and they were they didn't like each other either. There was a certain amount of envy, I think, and it was also built on by the rival newspapers, who wanted. You know, this was an era when, in comparison today, there were just hundreds and hundreds of newspapers in the U.S. So it was a really cutthroat industry, and they wanted to shift copies. And so, as you alluded to earlier, these gratuitous photos of the women in their bathing suits, and so this was used by the newspapers. And so I think it just, you know, the women got swept up, if you like, in the whole the newspaper war.
And I want to ask about that because you have a large supporting cast in the book with coaches and trainers and relatives of the swimmers. But then there are also these newspaper editors, writers, publishers who had sponsorship deals, who had then, if a swimmer was successful, had an exclusive access contract with the swimmer. So, and it appeared as I was reading it that this entire race across the channel was not so much about the athletes or the attempt at a great athletic feat, but it was really a media event.
It was a media event, and as I make clear in the book, that Italy in particular, but to an extent, with the exception, actually, with the exception of Mill Gade, who wasn't exploited by the newspapers, mainly because her husband, who was, as I said, a naval officer, really, from the sounds of things, a pretty formidable character, as Mill Gade was in her own right. But you know, these two were not going to be messed around. And whereas Lillian Cannon and Gertrude Edley in particular, you know, we've got to remember, she's only 19 at the time. Her father, I have to say, doesn't really come across as a particularly supportive, caring father. He was out, he owned a butcher's shop in Amsterdam Avenue in New York. He was clearly, you know, he saw that if his daughter swam the channel, he could do pretty well out of it himself. So he even exploited it to a degree. But no, they it was a media circus. And in the end, it ended up with Gertrude Edley being badly exploited to the point where she had a nervous breakdown.
Now, I'm not going to ask you about the attempts of each of these women to swim across the channel. And I know that you want to have people read the book. And I'll tell listeners that the chapters in which you describe the various attempts by these women to swim across the channel, particularly the swim by Claribel Barrett, make for truly gripping, page-turning reading. I really enjoyed those chapters where you describe the attempts by these women to get across the channel. But I do want to ask you about Edderley's attempts, since we do know that she did succeed, and she did it in record time in getting across the channel. But her swim was not without difficulty, correct?
Absolutely correct. No, it was a very difficult swim. The channel is, the weather changes can change so quickly in the channel. Because obviously you've got the North Sea to the east and the Atlantic to the west. And, you know, the weather patterns in both those oceans can change very quickly, and so it just shoots up the channel. And so Edley started at 7 o'clock on August 6th, 1926. Blue sky, still winds, quite a reasonable temperature, and within about 7 hours, around about early afternoon, suddenly the heavy thick clouds rolled in, the sea got up, and she was battling pretty ferocious waves and was being shunted from side to side and bruised. And as I think, as I say, she, at the end of it, she, her face resembled a heavyweight boxer's face, because she just got such a battering from the sea. And her lips were swollen, her face bruised, her tongue lacerated with the salt, and she was in a hell of a mess. So she was battling not just herself but also the weather, which was doing its utmost to try and defeat her.
So she makes it across. It's a grueling ordeal, but she surpasses the record that had been set by a man.
She shatters it, Bruce. Doesn't just surpasses it. She shatters it by. She swims in about 14 and a half hours, which is well over, and I think an hour and a half quicker than the previous best by a man. So she's not only the first woman to swim the channel, she's the fastest person ever to swim the channel by a huge margin of more than an hour. So it's an extraordinary feat in these very trying weather conditions. And it's an extraordinary achievement, and one that think testament to her spirit. There's a point where they have to change course quite near the end, when she's been in the water for about 12 hours, because the wind's so strong, it's going to push her actually past her original landing point into the North Sea, towards Holland, towards Germany. And it was an extraordinary achievement, and one that really did become headline news around the world.
Mm-hmm. And one story I knew about her before reading her book is that at a point her trainer wanted her to get out of the water, correct?
That's right. Her trainer, Bill Burgess, who I said earlier was the second man, the Englishman, the second man to swim the channel. At one point he ordered her out of the water, because he was fearful that she was going to drown because she was in such a bad way. And there's no doubt too. I mean, I think the other thing one's also got, always got to remember, Bruce, about these swims in 1926, there was none of this nutrition that we know today about carb loading, etc. I mean, for example, she was swimming. She had pineapple, which isn't too bad, but she was eating a lot of chocolate. Obviously, no energy drinks, just drinking water when she could. Hot beef soup, and that was it really. So so there were no, you know, obviously she was so having peaks and troughs, as any endurance athlete will tell you, when you begin to deplete your energy stores, that's, you know, that's when the hardest. And so her trainer, Bill Burgess, ordered her out of the water at one stage, and to which he replied, "What for?" And refused to come out of the water and just carried on. And she was an interesting personality, Gertrude Edley, because on the one hand she was very naive and probably not that intelligent, not very worldly wise. But she had this formidable self-will that I think she got to a point in that swim where she was drawing on reserve she didn't know she had. That's what enabled her to keep going when I think most of us would have just quit.
And so you say in the book that by the time she fell asleep in England in her hotel bed, she was already a celebrity back in the States. The news was hitting the newspapers that she had made the swim, had set a new record for women and for men. And so now she's a celebrity. And what were the demands that were put on her, and how did she handle them?
Well, the demands were huge. And one of the reasons she became such a celebrity was that it was obviously the 1920s was a time of great female emancipation in all walks of life. And you had these range of Hollywood stars, for example, and who were really, for the first time, you know, women were able to go out and work and earn their own wage. But they're also making lifestyle choices that their mothers would never have been able to make. So that's, I think, that helped create this great celebrity for Edley. And so the demands were, at first she had a manager in place, and she was offers to sponsor everything from chewing gum to toothpaste to obviously to swimwear came in. There were demands for Hollywood wanted her, she could have gone back to the US and been a multimillionaire probably within the month. Instead, she chose to go to Germany and visit her grandmother, which was a mistake because it's I think it probably diminished her somewhat in the eyes of Americans she was an American, but at the same time they wanted her to come back to America, not to go to Germany to visit some relative she hadn't seen for a long time. So I think she probably missed an opportunity to take control of her destiny herself. And it was another month before she returned to the US, by which time people were fighting over her as if she was really just a piece of meat. And it was very unseemly. And ultimately it damaged her considerably.
Yeah. And it seemed to me that she was just not, she was a swimmer, but was just not able to handle that attention, because even when she goes to Germany, she goes to her grandmother's village. You describe how the mayor and all these people were wanting to come see her, and she really retreated. You even describe the scene how she goes into the barn and she's with one of the cows while all of these people are clamoring to see her, and then when she does get to the States, she has, as you say, an emotional breakdown because of all the attention.
Absolutely. I think there's a case, Bruce, for saying that Gertrude Edley was one of the first celebrities, global celebrities of the 20th century, because it was a time, obviously, we talked about the photographs and the fact that you know, people were seeing what she looked like. They were following it. She wrote a daily column for New York Daily News. So people were really, it was a soap opera. But also there was silent film footage of her. which is played in cinemas back in the US. And so people, people thought that she was almost public property. And obviously, yes, of course, you had, you had these Louise Brooks and these big film stars, Douglas Fairbanks, but they were, like actors today, they were comfortable with being in the spotlight. You just said, you're quite right to say that Edley was a swimmer. She wasn't a celebrity. She was turned into a celebrity. And she was 19 years old. She just didn't know how to handle it. And to the point, that's right. I mean, in Germany, she thought she was going to visit her grandmother, but the German newspapers followed her everywhere. And really, she became a prisoner in her grandmother's home. And it just, the cumulative effect of all this intrusive media spotlight became too much for her. And when she got back to New York, and a million people plus turned up in New York City to a ticker tape parade, it became too much for her to bear.
So you've already hinted at it, but I was going to ask about that later, about this, as you were writing, what parallels did you see between this story and our current celebrity saturated or celebrity worshipping popular culture?
It surprised me to see that even 100 years ago, really, there was this demand for celebrities that in some ways, say Britain as an example, the British royal family were the celebrities of the 19th century. And then with the advent of, the newspapers, and photography and the cinema, it moved away into and Hollywood, obviously. And so it created new celebrities in film stars and sports stars. And that's the need has always been there to worship people. It's not something new. We think today of the celebrity culture. In fact, today, I think it's the difference is that we celebrities today, perhaps you might say, are celebrities for having, despite the fact they've got no discernible talent. At least Gertrude Edley had a huge talent. But people have always wanted to admire, to worship, to put people on a pedestal, if you like. And as I said just now, that Edley was one of the first examples of that, and it followed with obviously in that same era you had Babe Ruth, and then as I said, as I mentioned in the book, a year later you got Charles Lindbergh flying across the Atlantic, and he replaces Edley, if you like, and in a way takes the heat off her, because he's suddenly the new glamour boy, and he was slightly more comfortable with being in the spotlight than Edley. But no, I think there are many parallels to be drawn between the celebrity culture today and that of 100 years ago, and that our ancestors were perhaps just as in demand for celebrities as we are. Mm-hmm.
So something I want to ask about with that, since I know you did research in both British newspapers and American newspapers, how much overlap across the Atlantic did you see in this celebrity culture at the time? So you did mention Babe Ruth. You talk in the book about Jack Dempsey. I'm not thinking that Babe Ruth would have featured in newspapers in Britain. Likewise, someone like Dixie Dean would not have been in newspapers in the States. But how much overlap did you see in this emerging celebrity culture which featured athletes?
There was a big overlap, I think. As you say, not really with Babe Ruth or say for an England cricketer in the US, but Johnny Weissmuller obviously was a huge star both sides of the Atlantic, and Jack Dempsey and Gertrude Edley. So there was an overlap. Something else that I'd heard referred to in the book, Bruce, is that the British weren't very happy that an American woman, sort of an upstart colonial, if I can put it like that, mm-hmm. had the temerity to come to Europe and become the first woman to swim the Channel. So there was actually, not in all UK newspapers, but one or two UK newspapers wondered if perhaps she hadn't, there was, for example, a whispering campaign that she had used her support boat, she'd used two support boats to shelter her from the wind. And so she swam the channel, and, you know, in a way that really wasn't, jolly well wasn't fair, and not the sort of thing that a good upstanding British woman would do, which is absolute nonsense, as more than one British Channel expert was willing to testify to. But there was a certain jealousy, which I think was also as a result of Britain at that point was declining, and America was really becoming the global superpower. Britain knew this, and a lot of British people weren't happy with it. But by and large, the British people, I mean, there were 4,000 people were there, stayed up late at night to welcome Gertrude Everly to England when she scrambled ashore just east of Dover. So by and large, the British were the British people were wonderfully supportive of Gertrude Everly.
But this was something that surprised me in the book, in terms of looking at this as the origins of celebrity culture and athletes within celebrity culture, and something you see today is that almost immediately after she makes this tremendous feat, she's being criticized for it. And you talk about how some of it arises from a bit of British jealousy of this American coming over and swimming the channel. But then after she returns to the States, this criticism continues, especially when after Millie Gade successfully swims the channel. Can you talk about this this criticism of Edderly and what were the origins of it?
Well, I think she was criticized because she when she swam the channel, as I said, she was sponsored by the New York Daily News, and the in fact her she had a chaperone when she was in France. Julia Hartman, who was married to Westbrook Pegler, who was the big, this big sports columnist of the time, and went on to win a Pulitzer Prize early 1940s, I believe. So it was their story, their scoop. And once Gertrude Everly had swum the channel, it was staying a New York Daily News story. And she wasn't going to speak to any other American newspaper. And this obviously caused a lot of resentment in other newspapers. And so that led to criticism of her and of her swim attempt. I suppose picking up on the British theme that she'd swum it using her support boats as shelter from the wind, which was nonsense, as I said earlier. But there was a Gertrude Everly was socially very awkward, partly because she was already beginning to go deaf. Mm-hmm. She had measles as a child, and I think also a contributing factor was this constant swimming training affected her hearing, and so she was self-conscious and socially, and so she didn't handle the press well. And when she began to give a speaking engagement touring the States from east to west coast, north to south, she didn't know, it's a very tiring schedule, but she also didn't really establish a rapport with other American journalists because she felt she couldn't hear what they were saying. And they began to write rather derogatory articles about her. And again, I think that she was a very sensitive woman, contributed to her nervous breakdown.
So the channel swim or the race was in large part a media inspired event. And then, as we see with today's celebrity culture, you have someone who. The press doesn't like her for one reason or another, and they begin to kind of bring down her accomplishment.
That's right. That's right. It was a media circus in France and a media circus back in the States. And in fact, Julia Hartman, who was her chaperone, as I said, because she was over in France in a very small village in Cape Grenet, which is a very isolated, very rural part of northern France. And so she was there for best part of 10 weeks and not much to do. There was one, two hotels, no nightlife to speak of for a 19-year-old young woman. And so she got to have really a very looked on Julia Hartman as her, almost like an aunt, if you like. And the moment that they returned to New York, the New York Daily News got rid of, sort of pushed Julia Hartman out of the limelight. And so she lost that stabilizing influence, if you like. And I think that was another factor, that she was someone who she could trust. There weren't many people, I think, that Gertrude Everly trusted. I'm not sure she even trusted her father that much. And I think increasingly she found herself surrounded by people. You know, I suppose today is an example. You could use a lot of big name sports stars, particularly in the perhaps boxing. They're surrounded by a team of advisors who, one might say, haven't got their best interests at heart. And I think that became the case of Gertrude Everly when she returned to the States.
So I want to back up from Everly for a bit. And there's a great line in your acknowledgments section about how several publishers rejected this project because, and I'll quote your line, because it's just a book about swimming. And I'll be the one to say it. I know you probably don't want to burn your bridges, but those publishers were really dumb. And I say this because this book, you really do a masterful job of placing the swimming within several overlapping historical contexts. And you really fit this event nicely within the culture of the 1920s. And one of these contexts that I'd like to ask you about, and you hinted at it earlier, is how this race among female swimmers connects to the changes at the time in women's place in society, both in the United States and in Europe. And so when Ederle completed the crossing, how was this viewed as this great accomplishment, surpassing the best time by a man, as a great accomplishment by a woman?
That can't be overstated enough, Bruce, that it was a huge accomplishment. As it was... tens of thousands. There was the Red Cross swimming certificate, life-saving certificate, that in that time was I suppose the most prestigious swimming certificate one could have. Tens of thousands of American women signed up to get that certificate in the light of following Ederle's success. Don't forget, only less than 10 years before Ederle had swum the channel, women in America, it was still an offence to show a bare leg on a beach. This is quite extraordinary, but there was a famous American swimmer who I think competed in the Olympics, who was arrested in a beach in New York for daring to reveal take to the beach in a swimsuit that didn't cover her from her ankles to her neck. And so it was at a time when, and I mean, that was actually thrown out by the judge and it was taken to court. And so that was a big blow for women swimming. But the fact that Ederle had swum the channel faster than any other man, I think was proof that this whole nonsense about the weaker sex, that in fact, far from being the weaker sex, here she was, a woman, was certainly when it came to channel swimming, was the stronger sex. And it just gave so much self-confidence to women who were on both sides of the Atlantic, in the UK and the US, at the end of the First World War, during the First World War, 1916, 17, 18, when the men had been off fighting, women had taken jobs that hitherto had been forbidden to them, whether it was being... bus conductors, working on the subways, etc., delivering the mail, and then it had given them a taste of emancipation. And I think that it was gathering momentum, and with Ederle's swim, it was just further proof that really there were no limits to what women could achieve.
So what ultimately became of Gertrude Ederle?
Very sad story. She had a nervous breakdown in the fall of 1926. She, over the next two or three years, her hearing deteriorated to the point where she was deaf. She was engaged for a short while, and then her fiance abandoned her because he didn't want to spend the rest of his life with a deaf woman. As I said, she was a very sensitive woman. That really did break her heart. And she never again swam competitively. She got a job working in a Hollywood made a film about her in which she starred with B.B. Daniels in 1927, but with her hearing getting worse. And then in the early 1930s, she was visiting a friend when she and leaving the apartment, she slipped on the stairs and fell down a flight of stairs and broke her back and spent really the next year in a plaster cast. So if you can imagine, for a woman who had swum the Channel, for one of the great athletes of her time, she spent a year lying in bed in a plaster cast. And she never quite really recovered physically from that. And in the 1939 New York World Fair, she swam the highlights. One of the highlights was Gertrude Edley back in the swimming pool, back in swimming for the first time since her great Channel swim. And she swam a length of a 50-meter pool. And that was greeted with thunderous applause. So you could see that's in the space of 13 years, that's what her life had really come to. And then she, after the war, she never married. She lived in a Queen's apartment with three other friends. And yet she did find some great, I think, fulfillment in that she became a swimming instructor to deaf children in New York schools. And I think that gave her great pleasure because she felt, as we said earlier, she always felt socially awkward and yet with these deaf children, she was back in the water, and B, she was with people she understood and she could relate to. And I think so she did feel in the end some great fulfillment. And she lived to a ripe old age. She died in November 2003, aged 97. And her death was reported around the world. She was back in the spotlight nearly three quarters of a century after dominating the world's newspapers for a month or so. She was back in the spotlight, and so it was a life, if you like, that in a sense reached its pinnacle. If you're talking in the media sense, reached its pinnacle when she was 19 years old. But it was a long life, and I think she derived, there was great heartbreak, but also a degree of happiness in the end too.
Yeah, in reading it, the years immediately following her swim and her nervous breakdown and in the accident, it is, as you said, it's a tragic story. But you do end it with this note that she had gained some peace and contentment and was rightfully proud of what she accomplished.
That's right. She was, we said earlier, she was a swimmer, not a celebrity, and she achieved one of the great sporting accomplishments, really to become the first woman to swim a Channel in the what was then the fastest time ever, age 19 years old, was a wonderful achievement. And of course it's for that it's what she's famous for. Yet she did have she came back from this great depths of great misery and overcame so much heartbreak. And I think that showed the strength of the woman. We talked earlier that she showed great strength, great willpower in swimming the Channel. She also showed it in overcoming much unhappiness in her life.
So I want to ask a larger question. Earlier you talked about her swim as part of this larger period of, as you called it, a romantic age of exploration. And as I said, you've done work on early aviators, you've done work on Antarctic explorers, you've done work on, and with this book, on great athletic feats. And so that's an interesting way to put it, is viewing this attempt to swim across the Channel as part of this larger period of exploration and human accomplishment. And but my question is, as I remember as a kid, and perhaps you do too, is I remember coverage in magazines and on TV of Channel swims. I remember seeing the images of people greased up from head to toe. They look like They look like space aliens as they were heading into the water. And I remember coverage of polar expeditions and coverage of Everest climbs, but you don't get coverage of those anymore. You know, those accomplishments are now commonplace. And I want to ask you why you think that is.
Well, I think I mentioned earlier, Bruce, Charles Lindbergh, who in 1927, a year after Everly Swim, flew across the Atlantic in his airplane. And I think suddenly it was seen what was possible with a man and a machine and air travel. Then you had traveling the flying around the world, Amy Johnson, Amelia Earhart, and I mean, of course, you had space travel starting in the 1950s. And I think that with the discovery of the South Pole, the North Pole, you still had Everest, which was climbed in 1953. But I think it's almost, if you like, channel swimming, just specifically referring to channel swimming, suddenly became, if you like, unsexy, unglamorous, because there was no machine involved and it was old-fashioned. And, you know, that was all a bit sort of 19th century, if you like, whereas Charles Lindbergh was the future, and suddenly this whole new world opened up for us. And I think that energies were perhaps channeled in another direction. But also you had the rise of professional sports. So, you know, baseball, soccer, football, and track and field. The Olympics became bigger and bigger, more commercial. So I think that all those factors combined really helped diminish channel swimming, certainly, because people still swim the channel today. A lot of Americans still swim the channel today, but it's more just for the still a very good achievement, but it's there's no media circus now the way there was in 1926.
Yeah. So do you think, is there any athletic feat that could today gain the kind of attention that a channel swim gained back in the early 20th century?
Well, funny enough, I've been reading recently of will anyone run a sub-2-hour marathon? And so I suppose it's and of course you've had Usain Bolt, his extraordinary lowering of a 100-meter record. So I think perhaps the 2-hour marathon, in the way that the 4-minute was an extraordinary achievement. But no, I mean, I think really that the day of those great, I think we're just so obsessed now, aren't we? In England, for example, it's soccer. In the NFL, for example, in the States, we're so obsessed with these huge multi-million pound team sports now that really the individual achievements have gained less and less significance.
So we're almost out of time, but before I finish, I'd like to ask you about the style of your writing, which I really enjoyed. And I've done research in the past in sports pages of the 1920s, and it looked to me that your writing and I'm asking if you did it consciously, was colored a bit by your source material, by these newspapers from the 1920s. Was that accurate?
That's a good question. I suppose not consciously, no, but I'm sure subconsciously, yes, Bruce, because I have to say here that I'm a proud Englishman, I do love American sports writing. It's just got more colour to it. I think the British sports writing is more conservative. And so, and in the 1920s, it was, as I said, I mentioned earlier, Westbrook Pegler, who was very pithy and very... didn't mince his words. And so I suppose it's sort of having spent 3 weeks in the States researching the article, and I had my head buried in just about every American newspaper possible, I suppose you just absorb it and it's there. And so when I was writing it, because I was so, it was a wonderful story to write, possibly my favorite book of all the books I've written, because of the characters and because I love the 1920s, the whole jazz era, that, you know, the Hollywood, the beginning of the talkie films. That it just sort of came out and it was unstoppable.
So you mentioned, and I was actually going to ask that. So that style of sports writing, that very vivid, colorful, romantic style, that was not something that you see in British newspapers in the 20s then.
Oh, goodness me, no.
Oh, really?
No, no.
Okay.
Oh, no. They were very, well, a bit like, you know, if you imagine those sort of 1920, 30s Hollywood films you see of what life in life was, Britain, very stuffy, very not at all, very conservative, just really, I suppose, reporting the facts without recourse to spicing it up anyway.
So I'll ask to finish, what's your new project? What are you working on now? Or can you tell us?
I'm actually working on a book about a chap called Ralph Bagnold, who was a desert explorer. Is a British man who in the 1920s, again, what I said right at the beginning, an ordinary man doing an extraordinary thing, was took an old Ford car off to the Libyan desert and became the first white man to explore the interior of the Libyan desert, and with some other eccentric Englishmen. And later, when the Second World War started, he formed what was the called the Long Range Desert Group, which was a reconnaissance group that went deep behind German lines and gaining information on German convoys, etc. Which has proved a very important factor in Britain and winning the war in North Africa. So similar to continuing the theme, if you like, of these wonderful men who just do wonderful things.
Yeah. Okay. Very good. So I'll finish by saying once again, I really enjoyed this book, and to listeners, I'll say, contrary to what editors had said when seeing your project, this is not just a book about swimming. It's really a rich book, and I really enjoyed how you put each of these characters. I know we talked mostly about Ederle, but you really describe each of these characters, these women attempting to make this crossing, very well, and they really come to life. And as I said, I think it's a compliment to say that there were chapters that were true page turners. I really enjoyed it. So thank you, Gavin, for coming on New Books in Sports.
Thank you for having me, Bruce. It's been good to talk to you, and I'm glad you enjoyed the book so much. And I certainly enjoyed writing it and enjoyed, I suppose, doing justice to Gertrude Ederle, who was a wonderful woman.
Thank you. You've been listening to a conversation with Gavin Mortimer about his book, The Great Swim, published by Walker Books. New Books in Sports is part of the New Books Network, which offers more than 70 channels of podcast interviews with the authors of new publications. If you enjoyed the interview, please visit the Facebook page for New Books in Sports, where you can give us your feedback, get announcements of new interviews, and find links to thoughtful sports writing from around the world. I'm your host, Bruce Berglund. Thank you for listening, and have a pleasant week.